second. It's, you said you just made a mistake about your skipper?
My first boss in Naval Ordnance was not Boomer Hope. It was Rupert Wood. Yeah. Remember Wayneman Wood, his son?
Yeah.
It was Rupert Wood was the head of Naval, the director of Naval Ordnance when I went there in November 42.
Yeah. 40. The previous time, it's in the Navy. This is,
November 42.
So, I've forgotten what Mick Make ended up with in the way of guns. Did she have the 4.7s or 4-inch?
She had one 4-inch mounting and three 4.7 mountings. The first Mick Make and the first two was, and then the last two, Cayuga and
Athabasca.
Their armament was essentially the same, except there was a change in the 40 millimeter. We put a different 40 millimeter in, as I remember.
Yeah.
Then, of course, we were talking about the ships going to the Pacific, and we were beefing their armament up because we were going to send, about 15 frigates or so, and some destroyers, and a couple of cruisers. And then
the advantage of the 4-inch, of course, was it had a high angle capacity.
That's right, yeah.
Which the 4.7 didn't really have.
No, that's right. Then, of course, we started getting in, before I left, in September of 45, we started getting into the post-war Navy planning, proposals for that.
Tell me something about the post-war naval planning. Well, I mean, the Pacific War ended before we really got anybody out there.
Well, the planning was, as I remember, two cruisers, I don't know how many destroyers and some frigates.
Well, all the tribals and...
Oh, yeah. The rivers would all go.
The rivers would go, yeah.
But I really don't remember what it... But it was quite a nice little fleet, although not as... It wasn't any bigger than we got to about 1962 or 63 when we had the two cruisers and the Bonaventure and a bunch of destroyers and still some wartime frigates, which are still then... comparatively young by today's standards.
Well, they were used by then mostly for training, I think, weren't they? But we had our Blue Water Navy.
Oh yes.
Which the wartime admirals who were the pre-war RCN officers, they've been criticized in a way. Tommy Pullen was one that said, they said, you know, they should have been building more river class destroyers and frigates. But he said during the war, the pre-war officers were now getting up to admiral's rank, and they knew the war was ending, and they wanted a big ship navy.
Oh, yes.
And he doesn't think it was right. He said, we might have lost the war because they were building tribals. They were grand for bashing Narviks and Elbings in the channel, but the main problem we had was the submarines.
ASW, yes.
So the post-war admirals had their two cruisers, their carriers, and their tribals.
Yeah.
And Tommy Pullen doesn't think that was right. And come to think of it, I don't see how the pre-war officers could have thought any other way, because the RN and the German Navy and the Italian Navy were all big ship navies, and so they wanted one too.
Well, I think in retrospect, hindsight is great, Hal. The carrier made sense as a light carrier as an ASW carrier.
Yeah,
we should have one now. The two cruisers made sense as training boats, and that involves an investment of 600 or 700 men, crew to operate. You can operate them on less if they're out of training configuration.
Yeah.
Then go for the ASW vessels.
Yeah.
So I don't think I think of fairness, the cruisers were not a luxury in that sense. If we were going to be require ships of some size for training purposes. I mean, you can always decommission one of the turrets so you don't have to have a crew to operate that.
Yeah.
You could operate Ontario or Quebec or Uganda, as she was, and maybe 500 people if you're not keeping her going for fighting purposes.
Yeah, because the turret crews took up a lot of the ship's company.
Oh,
yeah,
damn right they did.
Oh, sure. Well, how long did you stay around after the war?
No time at all. when VJ came, I decided, I'd been thinking I might stay in the Navy, but I decided not to, and I decided I'd go to law school. So I was already waiting for my relief, because I was hoping to get a ship to go to the Pacific. Mm. And I had organized Mook Madrick to come and relieve me. Mook, as you remember, was in disgrace because he wouldn't volunteer.
Yeah.
He was the gunnery officer of the Ontario.
She was on her way out and he wouldn't volunteer. They had to replace
him. Well, she was still in Belfast refitting, and he wouldn't volunteer. And I had to find a relief, which turned out to be Paul McLaughlin, a friend of mine from Toronto, an RCNBR gunnery officer. And Paul was picked up the appointment, and Mook had to be relieved, and so I nailed him for relieving me. So I was going to go anyway, out of there, going somewhere, hopefully the Pacific, but I didn't get, I mean, no appointment had been made. And I walked out of there, and I guess about the first weekend of September or so, and by then I was Deputy Director of Warfare and Training, 2IC of the department, with you know, about 30, 40 officers and people. On Friday I was a commander, Deputy Director of Warfare and Training, and on Monday I was a law student delivering letters at $25 a week.
Yes, you got up to commander's rank as the war ended, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just before.
Yeah. That's quite a career. Midshipman in 36 to commander in 46. That's not bad.
No, I think I was the youngest commander on the list when the war ended.
Yeah.
Starchy Brown was also been, but he lost his when he ran his boats ashore somewhere near Iceland, remember?
Yeah. I didn't know that about Starchy.
Well, I think he said one of his wing ships hit the mud somewhere.
Wow.
He lost his group.
Mm. Well, it's not a good thing to do. So you're back in law school, which took you...
3 years.
3 years. You didn't go back into the Reserve Division immediately.
No, not until the spring of 47.
And then you went...
I couldn't get in. I wanted to get in, but I'd written a letter to, I don't know, I think it ended up on Hugh Pullen's desk. Hugh Pullen was Chief of Naval Personnel, and I'd heard that the Navy had been asked to provide a guard for some ceremony at City Hall, and I wrote a letter saying I thought this was terrible, that we didn't accept the invitation, and I, as an interested ex-naval officer, I blossom forth in print. That's been my problem all these years. I say too much, but when I applied to get into the unit, he wouldn't let me in right away. I had to fight to get back in.
But you did get back in as a commander.
Yeah.
Because you're going to be captain of York soon.
Yeah, 4 years later.
So were you XO or just
no,
A commander?
I was training commander.
You were training commander.
Yeah. Doug Bruce was the executive officer.
Oh, okay.
He came back and he stayed in for a while.
And 4 years later you became captain of HMCS York.
That's right.
And you were captain there for a long while.
4 years.
Yeah. And then you retired from York.
Yes.
You were promoted. I remember you as a Commodore, you were the... What was your title? You were the
Senior Naval Officer of Toronto Area.
Senior Naval Officer of Toronto Area.
Yeah.
What were your duties as a Senior Naval Officer of Toronto Area?
Well, really, you know, what do you do? You're sort of glad-handing people and representing the Navy and have some responsibility for looking after ships that come in and out. Done for. We had another reserve officer in Montreal, Paul Earle, you may remember.
Was he a Commodore there?
Yeah, he was a Commodore and Senior Naval Officer in Montreal.
Yeah.
My job was a duplication of his, but not nearly as busy.
How many nights a week did you spend at York when you were captain?
I don't think much more than one. I couldn't spend too much time.
You had your law practice, of course.
I was starting out in law, and... it wasn't so much what I spent at York as all the other extra activities, you know, because until I became senior naval officer, the CO of York was the senior naval officer in the Toronto area.
Yeah.
You know, military permanent establishment with a major general and Air Force people around, and the reserve Navy fellow was representing the Navy at all these official functions. So while I may have only been working, directly in the unit for one night a week, probably out about three or four nights a week every other, doing other things for the Navy.
Yeah. I've thought for years that you put in more time for the Navy than any other reserve officer I know.
No, that's not right, Hal. There's lots of people who have done far more than I have, but I did what I had to do and to the extent of my capabilities, but there are lots of people who have spent more time at it.
Because you've given a lot of time, a lot of your life to the Navy, haven't you?
Oh, I think so. I think I have to agree with you, sure. But it's been, it's been a labor of love. I've liked it. I've been frustrated and fed up and lots of time. But I really enjoyed it. I wouldn't have met people like you if it hadn't been the Navy.
I can see you might have won some cases in court if you've got the gift of the gab like that. So how long were you a Commodore then?
6 years.
Six years.
I was particularly pleased because I was the first VR officer to be promoted Commodore in peacetime. Yeah. See, we had Paul Earle, who was Director of Naval Personnel, as a Commodore in Ottawa during the war.
Yeah.
Of course, Archie McCallum, who was the Medical Director General.
Yeah.
And the two Brock brothers, Eustace and Reg.
Yeah.
And they were wartime promotions, so I was the first.
You were the first peacetime RCNVR to get promoted Commodore.
Yeah, well, RCNR at that time.
Okay. Yeah, you're RCNR now,
week,
aren't you?
One night a week sailors, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Did you get any medals for that? I don't mean your wartime medals.
No, I just got the long distance stuff. Well, I got picked up things like the Coronation Medal, which happened while I was there, and things like that, but. Yeah. I picked up my 20-year ribbon as a volunteer reserve officer and then my 12-year CD.
Yeah.
So I...
Well, it's a distinguished naval career. It really is. It really is. I've known that for 20 years, and now here here we have it. What do you want to say about the Navy? We're just about at the end.
Well, I think we've had a raw deal, starting with unification, obviously. I was very active in the unification debate as part of this group that were fighting it very strenuously. And I thought when I retired in 62, because I'd had 6 years as senior naval officer, and I could have stayed on, but I felt I'd had enough. And I thought, that's the end of it, and then this damn business was... going to destroy the Navy came along, and I got recruited into this group called TRIO, Tri-Services Identity Group, as a naval arm of it, and unfortunately I put a lot of time into that, and I sort of kept my interest going, and so I still have a deep and abiding interest in making sure the Navy gets back to where it should be.
Well, we're getting that way. You know, hearing Admiral Wood talk today, I have a lot of confidence in today's Navy. Admiral Wood is as good as I've ever seen anywhere, just from listening to him talk.
Yeah, he's a little more positive than some of the others.
He is. What was the question I was going to... Oh, yeah. Nelson Lay was the head of the TRIO group in Ottawa, and they were writing letters to the Prime Minister, and they weren't getting any answers, Nelson Lay told me. Mm. And so he wrote another letter, which was a copy of his last one, and he went to Sussex Drive and said, I have a letter that I want to deliver, and the RCMP man allowed it up, and he put it in the post box himself.
Yeah.
And he got a reply that it would be Lester Pearson, wouldn't it?
Yeah, Mike Pearson.
Mike Pearson. And, but he said that a lot of the people in his group didn't want to put their name to anything because they had civil service jobs, right. And they were afraid of their jobs.
Yeah, they were afraid of retaliation.
Yeah. Did you find that in Toronto?
Well, it couldn't affect me because I was in private practice. But we found some people who didn't want to stick their neck out, who were essentially in sympathy with us, but because they were maybe presidents of corporations who were doing business with the government or something, they'd say go to it, but they wouldn't do much else.
No.
In fairness, we had a pretty strong group in Toronto. Did a lot of work.
I think it was just ignored, don't you?
Well, it wasn't done on the military merits of the plan. It was done on a political matter, political basis, because it just became a question of confidence. Pearson allowed himself to be so deeply influenced by Hellyer, he couldn't back away from him. I heard one story, I don't know whether I couldn't prove it, but I heard that he told Hellyer one day that if there was one more general resigned, that was the end of it. You remember, there were quite a few officers, generals, as well as admirals.
And Air Force people who
resigned.
I've heard that story. He told it to Kai Bergelt, who lives here in town. Kai Bergelt was making an awful fuss in headquarters, so they sent him on a staff course. And now, when you get a staff course, it's a sign of two things. One is that they think a lot of you and they want to promote you, so they want to give you a staff course. And the other thing is they want to get you out of the way for a year. And he was sent down there for that reason. And Lester Pearson came down to talk to the staff college. And Lester Pearson told Kai Bergelt that, says Kai Bergelt. One more admiral resigned, I would have told Hellyer to pack it in. And one more didn't.
I'm glad to hear this from another source, although unfortunately it didn't happen.
No.
Look how we're trying to get back to it gradually. We've got our uniforms back, or a blue uniform back, and things have changed immeasurably, certainly in the nomenclature. You weren't allowed to use the word Navy in 1966-68 for several years. So it's creeping back, but why they won't just sort of take the bull by the horns and say, we made a bloody great mistake, let's fix it.
Well, the Liberals would never have said that.
No,
because,
but,
I mean, they made, but now we've got a Tory government that's got 4 years. Yeah,
sure.
I think it will come back. But it's been a traumatic. It's been 20 years, 65 to 85.
Sure.
65 to 85.
It was June 66 that Bill Landymore got sacked.
Yeah.
And Jeff Brock was really the first casualty.
Yeah.
In the fall of 65, and then Jack Caldwell in the spring of 66. Yeah. He was just quietly called in and fired.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Apparently, Hellyer called him in one day. Remember, Jack was chief of engineering, CMTS, chief of naval
technical services. Yeah.
He was called in and just said, "Out you go,
pack your bags." Well, we mustn't end on that note. The note we must end on is, first of all, I go back to the June meeting here. There were nearly 1,000 reserve officers came down here in June, and it was a very emotional week. It was a lovely week. And now, with the kind of conferences that Alec Douglas is arranging now, there's a new awareness from just our last 2 days, and we've got another day tomorrow look at that hectic discussion we had on the Arctic sovereignty.
We should have had that yesterday.
Yeah. It clears people's minds, and everybody's thinking about it again, about what's the best thing to do, and that's the start of everything that's good, isn't it? As long as we don't sink into apathy, as long as people are interested in. And all those academics that we're visiting are quite knowledgeable. Some of them waffle a bit, but they know what they're talking about.
But we have to, the government has to keep its determination up. I think this government went in with a determination to do something for the forces, but they're getting themselves in such a financial bind they're not going to be able to deliver because the money that they want to use isn't going to be there. Mm-hmm. And it may mean a reallocation of resources between the three services, but then that should be based on an appreciation of what our needs are, not on any traditional split.
Yeah. Well, Admiral Woods sure as heck doesn't want an icebreaker at the expense of the other ships that he's got coming along.
No, but
one thing that emerged today.
That's fair in that sense, Hal. But on the other hand, if there's a need for the icebreaker, and we have to keep maintain the other commitments which we've assumed and we're trying to maintain, then something else might have to give, and you have to start looking at what is there. And of course, people have been talking about the brigade in Europe. I personally think the brigade in Europe serves a very useful function in it. We can send people over there to work in the NATO command structure and that sort of thing, but from the point of view of providing troops, what the hell is 5,000 Canadian troops? Gee whiz, West Germany or any of the European countries can produce 5,000 troops a hell of a lot cheaper and quicker than we can. But I think we must be in that structure just for that purpose. But as far as the military utility of them is concerned, it's got to be balanced against what we need for something here, which is all part of the whole picture.
Well, what we've learned yesterday and today, and we'll learn more about tomorrow, is that it's being discussed and everybody's aware of the problem, and it's going to filter up, and a lot of good is going to come out of all this discussion with people like you that have been serving since 1936, and some of those people there today that are really quite young. Those young officers are pretty damned...
Well, I think it was great to see those young fellows from Royal Roads there.
Yeah.
And there are two. There's a young fellow from on Toronto, York. Uh-huh. There, who's a young lieutenant, computer scientist of some kind. I don't know whether he was sent down or he came on his own expense, but I think it's great to see them there to pick it up.
Well, the discussion is going on, and we'll get back to where we were. And if you and I had to do it all over again, I think we'd both say, what would you say? Would you do it all over again?
Well, that's hard to say because sometimes the pain was pretty bad, but I guess the answer is you don't know. If you go back 30 years and you don't know what's going to happen, you'd probably do it. Oh, yes, sure, I think I'd do it again.
Thank you very much indeed. Dr. Douglas will read this with great interest.
But in just before the white paper came out, they announced that they were going to cut back the reserve units, naval reserve units and air reserve units. They were going to set up a committee to examine the militia, to reorganize it. The poor bloody militia gets reorganized about every time the bell strikes. And they don't have anything else to do. They reorganize the militia, and that's why they can't get off the ground. But this came up in January of 64 at the Conference of Defense Associations, and the announcement had been made that there was going to be a committee to examine the militia. And there was nothing said about the Air Reserve or the Naval Reserve, other than the Naval Reserve was going to lose, I think, 7 units. The Air Reserve was going to be cut back. And so one of the Air Force people at the conference, Defense Associations, this was in the presence of Paul Hellyer, said, well, the militia is entitled to a commission. Can't we have a committee as well? And Hellyer, being a politician, said yes. So I got up and I said, well, that's great. And he said, all right. Pointed to one of the Air Force officers. They had a fellow. And he pointed at me and he said, and you'll chair the Naval Reserve unit, or the Naval Reserve Committee. And you've got 3 weeks to do a report on the efficacy or the propriety of these cuts that they've announced. They were cutting out units in Edmonton, London, Regina, Malahat, Esquimalt, here in Halifax. And you can give me a recommendation as to whether any or all of these should not be cut back. And so I took this on, and I organized three other members of the committee, Ross from Vancouver, McElhaga from Winnipeg, Bob Inman from Ottawa, and who was the other one? Maybe that was the four of us. And we went back and forth across the country listening to submissions from all the reserve units that were being cut as to why they shouldn't be cut. And that was probably one of the more gratifying periods of my reserve service, was able to do that committee and bring in a report. We did save two of the units. We were double-crossed, I think, on the whole thing. We were trying to make a case to keep them all. But we kept Halifax, we kept Esquimalt. And I was told that two other units would have been kept, and the Navy recommended it, but I think it was probably too much for Hellyer to back down on that many. In other words, show that he was wrong, 50% wrong, yeah, in this case. But that was quite an exercise.
Well, now that's a real victory for you, isn't it? I mean, and well, McElhaga and the rest, but...
Yeah, well, we were lucky in the timing and the way it worked out, because if we hadn't been there at the Conference of Defense Associations that day, we wouldn't have had an opportunity to do that. Now, Paul Hellyer and I were quite good friends.
I didn't know that.
Yes, we were, and I used to see him, and we'd talk over military things, and I was going to Ottawa more often in those days in my law practice, and I hit him on the airplane a couple of times, and we sat down and chatted and tell me where he'd been and what. So we got on very well, but when the unification debate steamed up, that was sort of the end of a beautiful friendship. But I was telling Bruce Olin that he's given me kindly enough credit for saving Scotian, but I said, you want to realize that maybe one of the things that did that was because Paul Hellyer and I at that time were quite friendly, and I think he was prepared to do something for me because of that relationship. And sure, you benefited by it, but it wasn't just because I was it wasn't because the recommendations as such that we made. It was a bit of a personality situation, and I believe that.
Yes, but I believe this. It was because you are the kind of man that you are that Paul Hellyer respected your opinion and said, I've got to give Bob Hendy this.
No,
If you hadn't been the kind of man you are, you wouldn't have had the time of day from him. So don't say...
Well, he's a politician, and but Paul had an interest in the job. I think, unfortunately, he got politicized in the unification debate. I think he didn't realize... He never thought the whole program through, as you well know.
No.
He didn't know where the hell he was going after, apart from the white paper, which was supposed to be very flexible, and that, you know, nothing is cast in concrete, and all this stuff that he put in the paper. But when it came down to the crunch, he started getting very rigid. And but he didn't know what to do with it. But it looked like a good thing, because he'd so persuaded the press and other people that this was the greatest thing that was ever invented, this unification, and therefore it became a political matter and a stepping stone to the leadership of the Liberal Party. That's the key to it. It lost its... His plan lost its merit as a military operation and became a political
Because the leadership of the party was coming up, and it gave him a lot of press.
Yeah.
Got a good press. He was going to be the man that saved the country money and unified these wasteful armed services into something efficient.
Well, that's true. And, of course, the defects of the system weren't apparent at the time of the leadership convention. But I do think that because of the opposition that was stirred up by people in things like the TRIO group and lots of others, and we weren't all alone, there were lots of others doing it, I think it did harm them because there was some feeling that maybe the thing had merit, the program that he outlined, but he'd done it in such a way as to concern people as to his methodology. I remember we had a dinner in Ottawa to talk this over, not me. There was the TRIO group and Paul asked for the whole defense council if they could attend the dinner, and that was quite a feat. We took a room in the Chateau Laurier, and the whole defense council, I think it was Allard, Ralph Hennessy was on it at that time, Freddie Sharp, and they all paraded in at Sharp at whatever, 7 o'clock, on Hellier's orders to discuss, you know, our position. They were obviously worried that we were making some yards. And in the course of the dinner conversation, he came up with this, or I knew he had come up with this program to create what might be called satellite cities to reduce the urban sprawl in places like Toronto, which was growing too fast, and try to decentralize. And I said to Paul, I said, well, that's fine. Suppose you decide you're going to build another city somewhere. How are you going to get people to go and live there? And he said, he just looked at me with a steely glint, and he said, we'll find a way. And it just scared the hell out of me, because if he'd been the leader, he was obviously leaning in a dictatorial way as to how he would implement his policies, rather than by selling them on their merits. He was going to do them irrespective. And that's really the way the reunification came along. He developed it. It sounded good. And then he couldn't back away from it.
He bulldozed it through.
Yeah. And he was advised that he'd better keep going, because if he'd ever once faltered, he was dead politically.
Yeah. Well, he's died politically since anyway, so...
Yes.
I don't take any satisfaction out of that, but he has.
I don't either. Because in some ways, he has a lot to contribute. He's been a very dedicated person to his points of view, and however...